News of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump visited the U.S.-Mexico border on Thursday. While Biden urged Congress to reconsider a bipartisan immigration bill that fell apart in the Senate, Trump focused on crimes committed by migrants.
Migrant crime. We call it Biden migrant crime, but that's a little bit long, so we'll just leave it. But every time you hear the term migrant crime, you know where that comes from. Allowing thousands and thousands and actually millions and millions of people to come. Could be 15 million, could be 18 million by the time he gets out of office, because hopefully the biggest risk we have is 9 months. That's a long time.
Right.
A lot of bad things can happen.
During Biden's visit to Brownsville, Texas, he urged Trump to reverse his opposition to the bipartisan immigration bill.
I understand my predecessor's legal past today. So here's what I would say to Mr. Trump. Instead of playing politics with this issue, instead of telling members of Congress to block this legislation, join me, or I'll join you, in telling the Congress to pass this bipartisan border security bill. We can do it together. You know and I know. It's the toughest, most efficient, most effective border security bill this country has ever seen. So instead of playing politics with the issue, why don't we just get together and get it done?
Immigration is expected to be a key issue in the November presidential election. For years, immigration policy has long been the issue that Washington lawmakers endlessly debated but cannot ever come to a resolution on. Authorities say fire raced through a seven-story building in an upscale area of the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka Thursday night, killing at least 43 people, injuring dozens more. Firefighters brought the blaze under control in about 2 hours, according to authorities. The government has ordered an investigation into that deadly fire. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. officials reacted with concern at the news of civilians killed while trying to get humanitarian aid in Gaza. We get more on this story from VOA's Jeff Custer.
Speaking to reporters as he left the White House Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden said they were still gathering information on the incident, and as he understood it, there were two versions of what happened. U.S. Agency for International Development Chief Samantha Powers, who was in the West Bank Thursday, said regardless of the circumstances, the incident should never have happened.
I know investigations are underway to find out exactly, again, what happened today. But again, a core principle that applies everywhere USAID and our partners work around the world is that desperate civilians trying to feed their starving families should not be shot at.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
AP correspondent Karen Chalmers now reports on the arrest of an editor of a top Russian independent newspaper.
The editor of a well-known Russian independent newspaper has been detained after being accused of discrediting Russia's military. Sergei Sokolov is the editor of Novaya Gazeta. He was detained by officers from Russia's Center for Combating Extremism. It said the charges are related to an article printed by the newspaper. Administrative charges, such as those given to Sokolov, are usually punishable by a fine or a short prison sentence. The date of Sokolov's hearing is not yet known. I'm Karen Chamas.
Here in the U.S., AP correspondent Ed Donahue now reports a young Pentagon leak suspect plans to change his plea.
Pentagon leak suspect Jack Teixeira is expected to plead guilty. Teixeira had previously pleaded not guilty. He is the Massachusetts Air National Guard member accused of leaking highly classified military documents about Russia's war in Ukraine and other sensitive national security topics on the social media platform Discord, which is popular with people who play online games. Investigators believe he led a private chat group called Thug Shaker Central. Court papers show the judge was asked to schedule a change of plea hearing next week. He's been behind bars for close to a year. Authorities haven't talked about a possible motive, but accounts of those in the online private chat group describe Teixeira as motivated more by bravado than ideology. I'm Ed Donahue.
Heavy gunfire has paralyzed Haiti's capital. At least four police officers killed as a powerful gang leader announced he will try to capture the country's police chief and government ministers. The move comes with Prime Minister Ariel Henry arriving in Kenya on Thursday, looking to finalize details for the deployment of a foreign armed force to help combat Haiti's criminal gangs. Gunmen shot at the country's main airport and other targets in a wave of violence Thursday that caught many by surprise. For more news, please join us, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti, Washington. Today is Friday, March 1st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Chad's prime minister aims to prepare his country for free and fair elections later this year.
From day one, when I was appointed prime minister, we made sure that we have independent bodies in charge of the election. We made sure that even the constitution we have introduced improvements, and the laws for the election introduced the possibility for independent people to run.
Haiti's prime minister is in Kenya for talks with President Ruto about deploying 1,000 police officers to Haiti. The UN calls for protection of human rights and health as the world marks Zero Discrimination Day today, Friday. Amnesty International urges Ghana's president not to sign into law the country's anti-gay bill.
Amnesty International is urging the president not to sign this bill. It is one of the most draconian bills on the continent, aside Uganda.
And one of the finalists of the 2023 Women Building Peace Award will discuss what the recognition means for the work she does. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's thoughts, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Chad's Prime Minister, Success Masra, says that he is committed to strengthening the country's institutions as a priority for his new administration. Masra, a former opposition leader, was appointed at the beginning of the year after his return from exile in the U.S. Prime Minister Masra tells Views Jackson Bungayi that as the country prepares for elections and a transition to civilian rule, his main task is to reform the economy and electoral institutions for free and fair elections.
We started the flight, which is a transitional period. We have a pilot, a co-pilot, and we want to have a soft landing. But we go through, you know, some zones of turbulence. But this is normal, you know, when you take a flight. This is something that happened. We had one in 2022, Black Thursday. We had, one also during the last days. And I want to pay tribute to all those who lose their lives, because no matter where they come from, they are Chadians, and their blood is Chadians' blood. And as head of the government, this is really something which is not good for no one. Mm. But this is also where we should rethink and find in this difficult situation a stone of hope, and make sure that through the reconciliation and through unity, we make sure that we have a soft landing, to make sure that, you know, by end of the year, Chadian people can choose their leaders.
Mm. In this case, the soft landing is the free, fair elections.
Free, fair election and inclusive election.
Right.
Because this is why, from day one, when I was appointed prime minister, we made sure that we have independent bodies in charge of the election. We made sure that even the constitution we have introduced improvements, and the laws for the election introduced the possibility for independent people to run.
Mm.
For women, you know, a minimum number and percentage for women, mandatory for every party,
for the
political,
youth.
For the youth, and for rural areas, to make sure that there is an ownership also at national level. And we intend, and we are going to train around 50,000 volunteers, you know, to be able to handle the poll boxes, etc.
Mr. Prime Minister, finally, given the regional challenges, particularly in the Sahel region, how is Chad contributing to the regional security and stability?
I think there is no other here. Our country, Chad, is the geographic center of Africa, is in Chad.
Mm.
The oldest man discovery in the world is in Chad, Tumai. So what we offer to the world is our humanity, despite the fact that we have development challenges. And this is the role that Chad is playing. This is the role that we intend to play in the Sahel region and above. I was mentioning the fact that despite the very difficult situation in Sudan, we kept our borders open to make sure that we can welcome our brothers and sisters who are flying, you know, who are leaving the country, going away because they are seeking home. Do you offer them home? Which shows, I think, our humanity. People over everything.
Mm.
But now, because we stood up with dignity, we need also a support of our friends of Chad, friends of the Chadian people, etc.
Success Mazra is charged, Prime Minister. He spoke with U.S. Jackson Mvungangi in Washington, D.C. Amnesty International is urging Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo to respect the human rights of all persons and not to sign the country's anti-LGBTQ bill into law. Ghana's parliament passed the Human Sexual Rights and Family Values Bill this week, criminalizing same-sex relations. It imposes a prison sentence of up to 3 years for anyone convicted of identifying as a LGBTQ+. One of its sponsors says the bill promotes Ghanaian family values and human rights. Genevieve Patenton is Amnesty International's Ghana Executive Director. She tells me that the bill is draconian and violates Ghana's constitution.
Amnesty International is quite disappointed that Parliament went ahead and passed this bill. However, it hasn't been a surprise because Parliament has been pushing for the passage of this bill since its introduction in 2021. So not surprised, but definitely disappointed that the passage has actually gone through.
I did speak with a member of parliament who is one of the sponsors of this bill, and he defended the bill, saying that this bill promotes Ghanaian values and human rights.
So for me, I personally am a Ghanaian. I was born here, and I personally do not feel the bill promotes any Ghanaian culture. How do you define culture? First of all, the bill is completely against our 1992 constitution, which clearly states that human rights for all must be protected. We've also looked at, you know, memos were sent to parliament during the readings of the bill, both from Chief Office of the Attorney General and also the Commission for Human Rights and Administrative Justice, and they all advised that the bill was completely against international human rights law, and it was also against Ghana's constitution, not forgetting that it's a private member's bill and has public funding implications as well.
What do you hope that President Nana Akufo-Addo would do?
Amnesty International is urging the president not to sign this bill. It is one of the most draconian bills on the continent. Aside Uganda, we all know that Uganda has passed a similar bill. It is going to silence journalists, it's going to silence academics, advocates, human rights defenders, and it's going to impact a lot of people. People are going to be accused of these things. Currently, since the bill has been passed, there have been forced evictions of persons who are suspected of being part of the LGBT community. There have been people that have been sacked from their jobs just because of suspicion of being gay. So already the bill has had a negative impact on Ghana, and it's going to be worse. There have been reports of pockets of violence against LGBT community or persons who are suspected. Now, the bill is not even clearly defining who is LGBT, who is gay. You know, it's a very vague definition. So is it the way I walk? Is it the way I talk? Is it my haircut? What makes me gay? So these are some of the issues we have with the bill, and we are urging the president not to sign.
Genevieve Patterson is Amnesty International's Ghana Executive Director. She spoke with us from the capital, Accra. Minority groups in society are often subjected to discrimination globally. This is according to a United Nations report that shows there is not much progress as far as discrimination is concerned. As the world marks Zero Discrimination Day today, March 1st, the UN is calling for the protection of human rights as a path to protecting health for all. Maureen Odhiambo reports.
Today is the 10th anniversary of Zero Discrimination Day with the theme of protecting everyone's health and rights. Countries and organizations are making efforts to ensure equality and fairness for all regardless of gender, age, sexuality, ethnicity or HIV status. But progress in achieving zero discrimination is at risk. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima says the attacks on rights are a threat to freedom, democracy and health.
Global solidarity has secured progress on human rights and towards equality. Today, 50 million more girls are in school since 2015. But this progress is not secure. Attacks on the rights of women and girls attacks on LGBTQ people and of other marginalized communities are on the rise. The forces pushing back human rights are also rolling back democratic gains, such as the right of citizens to organize.
The United Nations Program for HIV/AIDS, UNAIDS, says minority discrimination leads to failing public health as these communities are pushed away from vital health and social services. Omunyana Rujeje is the head of Human Rights UNAIDS Africa.
Public health efforts are undermined when laws and policies and practices or norms lead to punishment and discrimination or stigma for people who are minorities, sexual minorities, based on their gender, sexual orientation, migrant status, whether or not they use drugs, and if they're involved in sex work.
At the start of AIDS pandemic 40 years ago, two-thirds of countries in the world criminalized LGBTQ plus people. Today, two-thirds of countries do not. UNAIDS appeals to support for women movements and movements of the rights of LGBTQ plus people, racial justice, economic justice, climate justice, and for peace. Dianyema says as communities across the world stand up for rights, the United Nations supports the move.
It is only by protecting everyone's rights that we can protect everyone's health. Through upholding rights for all without discrimination, we will be able to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals and to secure a safer, fairer, kinder and happier world for everyone.
The UN says on this Zero Discrimination Day and throughout the entire month of March, various events and activities will serve as a reminder to this crucial lesson and emphasize the call for action by protecting everyone's health and rights. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiombo in San Francisco.
On the Voice of America, I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, March 1st. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry arrived in Kenya on Thursday to try to salvage a plan for Kenya to deploy 1,000 police officers to the troubled Caribbean nation to help combat gang violence. According to the Associated Press, Henry was invited by Kenyan President William Ruto to finalize modalities for agreements between the two countries on the deployment. Kenya agreed in October last year to lead a UN-authorized international police force to Haiti, but the Kenyan High Court ruled that the plan was unconstitutional last month. Political analyst David Monda tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that legal challenges remain irrespective of any agreement between the two leaders.
It's a diplomatic move. I believe the Kenyan and Haitian government are trying to get some kind of reciprocal agreement together that will make it constitutional to have send these Kenyan troops to Haiti. However, the challenges still remain around the language question. The Kenyan police don't speak French. There's concerns about human rights abuses of Kenyan police in Kenya and how this will be done in Haiti. And then the fundamental question I think the Ruto administration hasn't explained to Kenyans is, what is Kenya's national interest in this mission to Haiti? When other more powerful countries are not intervening, why should Kenya be the country to send troops to Haiti when there's so many problems in Kenya and within the East African region?
Despite whatever the leader of Haiti and the President Ruto agree, can that agreement circumvent the court's ruling, which also said the Kenyan National Police Service cannot be deployed outside the country?
I think this will be open to constitutional interpretation, because I think even if they sign the agreement, I believe the human rights organizations are still going to sue to say that it is still not constitutional from a number of perspectives. And I think one of the big questions that's still up in the air is that Prime Minister Henry is not elected. He's in office illegally. he doesn't have a mandate. So in whose name is he signing this agreement? Because constitutionally, he's not the president because his term ended. So I think this is another huge problem in terms of the legality of this decision.
President Ruto posted on X, formerly Twitter, that Kenya associates itself with the people of Haiti because of a common heritage. In your opinion, is that reason enough for him to try, by all means, to send troops to Haiti?
I think it's talking about a common heritage, which is a strong point in terms of the global South developing nations helping each other out of different problems. But I think, again, the broader question that President Ruto has not answered, has not brought before the Kenyan people, is to say, why is Kenya sending this group there? How is it in Kenya's national interest that these police officers are actually going to Haiti? And then how will the police deal with the 500,000 wet guns that are in the street, the vigilante groups? What happens when Kenya police start getting kidnapped and start getting killed? Who will evacuate them when conditions become really bad and untenable? So this case has not really been made to the Kenyan people. As much as we have the solidarity of black nations, solidarity in and of itself is not a national interest.
That was David Morda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Umpuga from New York City. The U.S. Institute of Peace is welcoming its 2023 Women Building Peace Award recipient, Petronili Vawika of the Democratic Republic of Congo, along with three finalists, including Hamisa Zaja of Kenya. Zaja is the founder and chairperson of the Coast Association for Persons with Disabilities, a non-governmental organization in Mombasa, Kenya, that works to empower persons with disabilities. The Institute of Peace says these women stand as beacons of resilience, bravery, and commitment on the front lines of conflict. Hamisa Zaja tells me the recognition is an encouragement for her to do more.
The award to me, to my family, and the community I come from is something huge. Something that we didn't expect, but it also means that it's an encouragement, it's hope, it's a future, and it's something that it will be driving me to my last breath.
You lead an organization that works to empower people with disabilities. Can you describe for us just two ways in which you are helping to empower people?
Many of persons living with disabilities, especially in our areas or in my country, don't get jobs. Even if they had gone to school, they have get education, they have degrees, they have masters, getting jobs according to their types of disability, it's very difficult. So empowerment is the only option we have to get our livelihood. So small businesses and initiatives that are income generating projects, those are the type of empowerment that I do. If you are capable of selling fish, we'll give you all the equipment and an amount of money that you're going to buy your first startup and you start. If you are capable of selling vegetables, we'll do that. If you can work in, for example, one of the initiatives that I have done is called individual businesses. Each and every person to get their own businesses according to the areas of where they come from. And one of the initiatives that I did is turning public toilets into income-generating projects. All the public toilets, I got a partner, renovated the public toilets, and then now we hired cashiers, cleaners, those people who will be transferring funds from the project to the bank, and they get salary out of that. And some youth groups and women groups and also persons living with disability groups, those who are not working to the project, they become suppliers. They supply the liquid soap, they supply the toilet papers, they supply water. So that's how also the other groups get their income as suppliers to the projects.
Now, in terms of peace building, I mean, everywhere you look these days in Africa, you see conflict.
I'm sure also the people of disability that you deal with, they also have conflicts. How do you do it? How do you bring about peace?
I brought peace because persons living with disability needs a peaceful environment so that they can work and earn their livelihood. But we found out that we cannot work if our people are jobless and they are lured to conflicts, they are lured to drug abuse, they are lured to violence extremism, they are lured to radicalization, they are lured into many, many groups and gangs, and they become robbers, they become terrorists, they become so many things. So this is where now, in regards to peace, I thought also I should include into my program youths, women, and persons living with disability to give them income-generating projects that they will keep them busy, and of course they will be generating money for them now to stop whatever they want to do.
Ms. Hamisa Zaja, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk with us, and congratulations.
Thank you also for the opportunity. Thank you for the platform.
Hamisa Zaja is the founder and chairperson of the Coast Association for Persons with Disabilities in Kenya. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with athletics, where double Olympic gold medalist Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya will be out to reclaim his title in the 2024 Tokyo Marathon this Sunday, where he set a course record of 2 hours, 2 minutes and 14 seconds. The 39-year-old is already in Japan in readiness for the marathon, where he's also expected to better his record in familiar surroundings. Kipchoge will hope to pay tribute to his fallen compatriot, the late Kevin Kiptum, who holds the world record of 2 hours 35 seconds from the 2023 Chicago Marathon, who tragically lost his life in a road accident on the 11th of February. Staying with athletics, the world's best athlete will this weekend compete for honors in Scotland at the World Athletics Indoor Championships Glasgow 2024 from the 1st to the 3rd of March. A total of 651 athletes from 133 teams have been entered to compete in Glasgow. These weekend competition in the Scottish city is the first of 5 World Athletics Series events taking place in 2024, a year that features the Olympic Games in Paris in August. Kenya is sending 12 athletes to the championships. Bernard Ouma is Kenya's team's head coach.
We've been sending teams to indoor and they're winning very well, from 3,000 meters, 15, 800 meters. For the first time, we're sending a team for 600 meters by Omanyala and a relay team, and we are happy with the look. Quite promising and strong, they're going to perform well.
In women's football, the last 4 teams standing to contest for the 2 spots reserved for Africa at the 2024 Paris Olympics have been confirmed. Morocco, Nigeria, South Africa and Zambia, who interestingly are the 4 teams that represented Africa at the last FIFA Women's World Cup, are the final 4 remaining in contention for a place in Paris later this year. The final round of qualifiers will see South Africa facing Nigeria, while Zambia will take on Morocco in a 2-legged fixtures between the 1st to the 9th of April 2024, where 2 teams are expected to emerge to represent the continent at the women's football event. And finally, in basketball news, as preparations for Basketball Africa League 2024 enter a crucial stage, Doubleton APR of Rwanda, the Rwandan champions, are currently holding a 10-day training camp in Doha, Qatar, as they look to defy odds on their very first appearance at the Continental Premier Club basketball competition. Kigali has since 2021 been hosting BAL playoffs and finals, but no Rwandan team managed to lead the championship on home soil. APR's point guard Michael Dixon Jr. says the team has been coming together as there's a lot of positive energy in camp.
We're here in Qatar having preparation for Basketball Africa League. Things have been going great. We've won 3 games so far. Team is really coming together, and a lot of camaraderie and positive energy and good situations and success.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.